Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell.
Hello out there in Radio Land. It is time for the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics live-ish. It's live to us here at Studio A in Podcast Village in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. Joining me in studio for this broadcast is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. He is the one that we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And across the table from me is the retired one-star admiral from your United States Navy, the one we know as Admiral Ken Carradine. Hello, Admiral.
Hi, Justin.
And we are going in-depth on the latest coming out of Washington. Let's start with Andrew George McCabe. In case you don't know who Andrew George McCabe is, Andrew George McCabe is a 20-some year veteran of the Federal Bureau of Information, Federal Bureau of Investigation. From May 9th to August 7th of 2017, he was the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation after President Trump fired former director James Comey. He served as deputy director, the number two guy at the Bureau from 2016 to 2018. He is widely respected, lifelong Republican, and now, as of this week, author of a book that is not too flattering to politics in Washington under a Trump administration. Over the weekend of the Valentine's Day weekend here in Washington, everybody was glued to their TVs on a certain Sunday because on a 60 Minutes interview recently, Andrew McCabe gave an interview to 60 Minutes, which to say that it was stunning, to say it was informative, eye-opening, concerning, all understatements. It has sent the White House, it has sent President Trump into a Twitter tirade that has been going on nonstop now for, I would say, the better part of about 48 hours. It got a lot of people talking here inside the Beltway as to what could possibly happen and what is going on. And you've got former congressman and former congressional oversight chairman Jason Chaffetz saying that Andrew McCabe should be prosecuted for his 60 Minutes interview. You've got Meghan McCain asking him directly, was he the author of the New York Times op-ed? It has got everybody a buzz, but let's start with the biggie, which was a revelation during this interview that McCabe, in a meeting with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, it came out earlier and it was played off by the Department of Justice press folks as kind of being kind of joking, but it came out again in the interview that was Rod Rosenstein actually joking or not about wearing a wire into the White House and possibly invoking the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and we'll go into that in a little bit here, but really throwing all kinds of new light or gas on a fire that's already been ignited regarding Rod Rosenstein. Now, for the record, as of this broadcast, it has been announced that Rod Rosenstein will in fact be leaving the Department of Justice in 3 weeks' time, which there are some calling it coincidental. There are some saying it may be as a result of this interview that Andy McCabe gave to 60 Minutes and the book being released, all kinds of different things. But let's talk about the interview itself. Alan, you saw the interview. To me, number one, does McCabe come across as credible to you?
He does come across as credible. He also comes across as incredibly angry. He has reason to be angry. The president summarily
Before you go down that, why do you find him credible?
Because he's articulate. He's thoughtful. He has information that makes sense. So I have no reason to question or doubt what he was saying. He was 21 years at the FBI. He had advanced to the second most important position. That's why I find him credible.
Let me throw this out there.
I'm not sure what your question is.
No. Let me throw this out there because just to cover both sides, is there are detractors of McCabe that are saying that he was fired because of the fact that he lied to his own FBI investigators. The detractors also say that the Inspector General's report that came out where he lied about leaking information to the New York Times regarding the Clinton investigation, that comes into play. All that being considered, can Andrew McCabe still be credible to you, Alan?
How many times do I need to say yes? Does that mean that that he's not in a self-serving position? Hell no. He was treated shabbily by this president. He was trashed by the president. His wife was trashed by the president. He talked about that a little bit in the interview. It was kind of weird and bizarre. How's it feel for your wife to be a loser?
Right.
All kinds of bizarre little nuggets. With regard to the thing that bothered me about the interview, most of all, there were two things. One, the way he talked about Rosenstein, because Rosenstein cannot defend himself yet. He's got to wait till he's done. He hadn't, by the way, mentioned months ago that he expected to leave the department when a new attorney general was confirmed. We've got a confirmation. Rosenstein will leave. This, I don't think anybody can make a credible case that this was a result of McCabe stuff. But what McCabe said was two things. One, that Rosenstein at one point in a meeting when they were talking about how challenging this president was and how he was all over the lot and they weren't sure what kind of connections really existed with the Russians, Rosenstein pointed out, I could go in with a wire. They never checked me or anything. It's not that he was, and he had the power to authorize that if he wanted to. He didn't do it. He talked about it. And we knew about this before. This was reported many, many months ago, and now it's like this new thing. And then there was all this talk about the 25th Amendment. You know something? When those guys talked about the 25th Amendment early in 2018, early in 2017. So did everybody else. We did on this show. Other people talked about it. There were newspaper stories about what it was, how it worked, and you know what? The deputy attorney general has no power at all, zero, none, to make anything happen vis-a-vis the 25th Amendment. The vice president and a majority of members of the cabinet have to publicly say the president is not
capable of serving. They have to sign a document. They have to actually put their signature
in
paper.
So the notion that Rosenstein had some unique special power to move that forward is a complete nonsense.
But is that what he was saying? Because I took it a little bit differently. I think that Rosenstein was saying, look, I can draw up the document, but it's going to take members of the cabinet to sign off on this to invoke the 25th Amendment.
I never heard any reference to him saying I could sign up the document. This was a conversation. You may be making that up, but I didn't see that.
I didn't get the impression that he was saying that Rod Rosenstein had the power to invoke the 25th Amendment. I didn't read it that way.
All I got was these guys had a conversation about
it. Which they can do. Fine. We've had a conversation about it.
My point, everybody was talking about the 25th Amendment at that point. And we had heard that these conversations, we had heard months ago, over a year ago, that these conversations had occurred. And now McCabe is verifying what we had heard before, that Rosenstein had talked about the 25th Amendment and how it worked, along with everybody else and probably a lot of cabinet members. which Rosenstein was not one of at the time. And so it the fact that McCabe was sort of talking about that, about a guy who's still serving, who can't defend himself, that bugged me. I just thought, what's the point here? And I did have a problem with that part of what McCabe said. I just noticed that this afternoon that now that the book is apparently out, McCabe has also trashed former Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
Yeah,
so
and,
let that be known too.
You were going to say something, Admiral Ken?
Yeah. So living in the extremely red county that I live in. Down in Boca del Vista, I understand the anxiety that I think Trump supporters have with regard to people like Rod Rosenstein and Andy McCabe talking about the invocation of the 25th Amendment. So consider that here are two high-level people who are running the Justice Department and the FBI. Making comments about the possible removal of a newly elected and duly elected president of the United States. It's just not appropriate. It's as inappropriate as talking about something untoward physically happening to the president by anybody. All I'm saying is I think that if you take a step back.
Let me just ask you a question, just to clarify.
Sure.
Do you think what Andrew McCabe has said, both publicly or maybe in his book, is that treasonous, or is that indicative of a coup?
No, I think it's inappropriate. I think it's very, very apolitical for someone at that level in Washington D.C. And I think it's not very responsible discussions to be had in a public setting or even in an office setting. Again,
Hold on, let me
finish my answer to the question. Okay, so. Us sitting around this table or other media events or organizations sitting around a table talking about the possible removal of the president via 25th Amendment is one thing. But high-level government officials talking about it and the word getting out that they talked about it, I think makes people uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable.
But you don't want to know the fact that discussion has been had.
I didn't say that. I did not say that I didn't want to know. All I'm saying is that the fact that it happened, that conversation took place by senior government officials is troubling. It's very troubling, and I think it's inappropriate.
Alan, you agree?
No, I don't agree with that. What I think is that that I would be surprised if most of the senior members of the cabinet had not gotten themselves briefed on how the 25th Amendment works. Tillerson would have done it. Mattis would have done it.
We're saying two different things.
Priebus would have done it. These guys would have said, "What the heck is going on?" I don't know that we're saying two different things.
I think we are.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah,
we
no.
don't know. So it doesn't bother me that these guys might try to understand how that worked and what was going on.
That's
and how
not
it
what
worked.
Was happening.
Tell us what was happening, Ken.
What was happening?
I'm only going by what McCabe said in the interview.
But that's what I'm saying. Is tell us what your impression.
My impression of what McCabe was saying in an interview is that while Rob Rosenstein may have presented it as is nonsensical, non-serious musings, he took it as a serious discussion about the possibility of them aiding and creating an environment to where the 25th Amendment could be executed by the vice president or members of the cabinet. That's how I understand.
All right, let me ask this question.
I don't see any basis for that.
All right, but hold on.
What he said.
If that's your understanding,
I watched the interview.
I did too.
Hold on.
Okay.
Let me ask this question. If that is your impression, what bothers you about the fact that senior level people in the Department of Justice were talking about or getting clarification as the head lawyers of the federal government to get a discussion going about if this were to happen? I don't get the impression that they were saying that this was an active possibility. I think the discussion was that, hey, this might be a good discussion point here at DOJ, because the way I heard it or the way I interpreted it is there may be others in the administration that are having these same discussions and getting clarification, kind of like what Alan was saying.
So I think that obvious.
Why would that bother you?
Well, so in the context in which you just described it, that does not bother me. But in the context, as I understood the course of the interview, that does. Because I'm sorry, what I took away from that apparently is different than what you and Alan took away from it. And again, I positioned this point.
And there are others that see your point, by the way.
And I positioned this point from the perspective of those who are adamant supporters of the president. I can see why they would. I can see why the president, and I can see why they would be upset by this.
If you turn on Fox News over the past 48 hours,
and I do,
they are using the C word a lot.
Of course they are.
They're saying that this was a coup attempt.
Again,
was a silent or a soft coup.
Hence my comment.
Hence my comment.
So senior government officials, directors, flag officers, generals have this responsibility to basically couch what they're saying and to choose their words very carefully in public and in private. I'm sorry. And so all they've done is given the Fox News people and the aforementioned 35% room to churn and suck the feet on.
You didn't like the King Mutiny, did you?
I loved it. It was great. It was fantastic. And you know what? I'm glad you brought that up because if you think about it, that's a great metaphor for this situation. It's huge. It's awesome. It's fantastic for that.
And for those of you who haven't watched it, it's a great
book. Read the book. Read the book.
Herman Wolk wrote a book called The King Mutiny. Go read that, but we won't go down that rabbit hole right now. Alan Moore, again, going back to this idea that people are talking about, including people like Jason Chaffetz and every talking head on Fox News are talking about the fact that this was the beginning of a soft or silent coup. Do you agree with that assessment?
No.
Or is this just
I do
more
not.
Fear-mongering?
It's fear-mongering.
Absolutely
It feeds paranoia, and as Ken very accurately says—
But it's not paranoia if they're actually coming to get you.
No, I'm saying, but if you think that there's a deep state or some group of people that are trying to undo the results of an election, and here's more evidence of that, it feeds that narrative. But we're eventually going to see a bunch of other books, I hope, from the likes of
Rod Rosenstein in three weeks.
No, I'm thinking more like Rex Tillerson, Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, where they will talk about conversations they had with each other about the 25th Amendment, which if Tillerson and Mattis ever had a conversation, first of all, it wouldn't be in a group.
Wait a minute. If Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster, anybody else talks about this, talk about a 25th Amendment, does that feed into, oh my God, this was a coup?
It all feeds into it if for those who want to think that way. All I'm saying is anybody who had a friend, and I don't know how close Tillerson and Mattis actually were, they had big jobs and they weren't together all that much. But if the two of them, let's go back to the two. Once you get three people in a room, then it looks more like a conspiracy. But if it's two guys saying, so what's this 25th Amendment thing? Who else, you know? I mean, Tillerson calls the guy a moron, and we know that Mattis was probably more careful with his words, but clearly had his own major concerns and problems. They talk about it. It doesn't mean that they then start organizing and say, okay, you talk to these three, and I'll talk to those three. It's trying to understand and reflect and say, what would it take to get us to that point?
And remember the context of this. Okay, so the information about this discussion is coming in after the FBI in the last year and a half has been simply pilloried. I've got people who have been loyal, patriotic, fellow members of the armed service that are looking at the FBI like they're the second coming of the devil, and they're not. By and large, 99.9% of every FBI agent takes the same oath of office that you and I have taken, Justin, and are doing a really, really tough, hard job that most people would shy away from. And now you're basically taking this, and it's like, oh yeah, here we go again. And that's why the Fox News knuckleheads are having the field day that they're having.
Of course, you're gonna have that. When you got people like Ron Bongine, talking about this, that doesn't help the situation.
Jason Chaffetz, who couldn't
Jason
get into Chaffetz, the FBI.
I mean couldn't get into the Secret Service.
Yeah, okay.
That was then. We don't want to go down. We don't talk about Fight Club. But here's the thing is, Andrew McCabe this morning with Savannah Guthrie on Today's Show.
Didn't see that.
Says to Savannah Guthrie, and the clip's out there. You can go find it. Basically told Savannah Guthrie that he testified in front of the Gang of Eight and said, look, we're starting an open investigation on Donald Trump. And both Republicans and Democrats didn't push back from that. Regarding
the possibility of collusion with the Russians.
Right.
It was all about the Russians. It was what drove Flynn out, the lies. There were all these connections. There was all this intelligence that suggested that the Russians had gotten involved, had been involved. And then the president's own behavior raised questions about whether he might have known, and he or people very close to him might have known and been part of some kind of collusive activity.
But when you're the,
and that's why
when you
start
are the head,
investigating.
Right. But when you are the head, although acting, you are the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is the primary investigative service for counterterrorism here in the United States, and you present evidence of intrusion into the rightful election here in the United States, and you have the proof to show the president, and the president says, I don't care, I believe Putin. That is a huge problem, which would tell me, A, he doesn't believe his own intelligence services or doesn't want to believe them. Two, loves Trump more than he loves Andrew McCabe, his own advisor. Loves Putin rather than McCabe, his own advisor. And three, calls into question, could this president, at that time, could this president have been compromised?
Absolutely. That's why
nobody pushed back in the Gang of Eight.
And he fired Comey.
Right. That's right. He fired the actual director of the FBI.
And that's when McCabe became the acting. And then very shortly after that, he goes and trashes Comey. He meets the day after he fired Comey with the Russian ambassador and Russian foreign minister and jokes about what a scumbag Comey was.
And how the pressure's off now that he's gotten rid of him.
He doesn't debrief. There. My recollection is in that particular conversation, he was using a Russian translator. Didn't he have an American in the room? He was doing all these things that look suspicious. And McCabe or anybody else who was acting director would have been guilty of dereliction of duty had they not opened an investigation. Now McCabe is dislocating his shoulder, trying to pat himself on the back for getting this started in a way that they wouldn't be able to stop. Fine, but I think that was inevitable, given everything on its face. It was all out there for everyone to see. And then the president goes and talks to NBC and says, yeah, the Russian deal, that was part of why I got rid of him, wanted to clear that up. And it was known, of course, that he had tried to get Comey to back off of Flynn, and Comey had appropriately shared that inside. There were all these little pieces that said, go take a deeper look. That's what they did. The president slowly began to figure that out. But here's the thing, at no point,
I mean, let's get this knocked out of the way. Is there any indication, Admiral Ken, that what Andrew McCabe did during his tenure as acting director of the FBI or as deputy director or as anybody actively involved in the Clinton administration or the Clinton email investigation or the current investigation under Trump, is there any indication Andrew McCabe did anything that would be treasonous or would constitute a coup?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Alan, you agree?
Oh, totally. Okay. Totally. He was clearly angry. He got fired.
He should be.
McCabe got fired 26 hours before he would have been eligible for a pension,
which was retribution.
Petty garbage. Yeah. He was the subject of an inspector general report that found that he did in fact say a lie to the inspector general. That's serious stuff.
Right.
That was idiotic.
We're going to talk about this when we come back. We're going to talk about this. We're going to continue our in-depth conversation on Andrew McCabe, the president, and the intelligence services here in the United States. This is Backroom Politics, the best political talk show you never heard of from Podcast Village. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
And now we're reacquainted, and all the stars seem fresh painted, and here's what I long to say to you. Hello. Where have you been? If you could only read my mind, what a tale you'd find. If I could, I would be bound forever, and I'd never sever me from you. You won't believe it's true, but I've been missing you. I dream of kissing you. Let's give it one more chance, one more slow dance. Heartstring, let's cling, tie my heart to you. Hello, heartstring, where have you been? If you could only read my mind, what a tale you'd find. If I could, I would be back.
Of him, how much I love him, I get a desperate notion, that's the way I feel today. My heart is aching.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell. And we're back here at Studio A at Podcast Village here in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., for the best political talk show you've never heard of. Joining me in studio, Admiral Ken Carradine, the Honorable Alan Moore. We've got Rob, the engineer behind the glass, keeping us accurate, keeping us safe. We're going to continue in-depth talk about the Andrew McCabe situation, the situation with the intel services, and the relationship with the White House. Let's finish up on this Andrew McCabe thing. Right before we went to break, we were talking about the revelation this morning that Andrew McCabe told Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show that, in fact, he had briefed the what we know as the Gang of Eight here in Washington, which are your four top Republican, your four top Democrats. about the opening of an investigation regarding the inappropriate relationships with the Russians, Donald Trump, and those in his cabinet. And at that point, according to Andrew McCabe, none of the Gang of Eight pushed back on it. To me, Admiral Ken, between what I've heard from McCabe on the 60 Minutes interview, what we've heard from McCabe this morning, and other reports that we've heard, the lack of, I don't know if it's the lack of trust between the Oval Office and the intelligence communities, or is it just, I don't want to see it, I don't want to hear it, and therefore if I don't see it, I don't hear it, it's not true. What is the problem with the relationship between the president and the intelligence communities?
I'm struggling for words that are not too disrespectful.
And let me just connect the dots here for a second while you're thinking about that. The reason why I bring it up is
why?
Yeah, exactly. The reason why
I bring this listening.
Up, well, the reason why I bring this up is the FBI is in fact has a seat and part of what we would consider the intelligence community,
yes,
which includes the Central Intelligence Agency,
yes,
Defense Intelligence Agency,
NSA,
and the National
NSC.
Security Agency,
yep,
and others, which includes, in this case, the FBI and the Department of Justice. But that being the case, what I go back to my original question, what is the problem with the relationship between the Oval Office and the intelligence community right now?
So thank you for that break. I think the problem is that the president of the United States is trying to run the country the same way he ran his business. And whatever his view of reality is the view of reality that everyone around him should have, share, and promulgate. I think that is basically the issue. I think that based on not just what Andy McCabe said during his interview, but what we have seen as evidence toward his attitude toward Dan Coats, his attitude toward Rex Tillerson, and a whole host of others who have now are watching this administration on TV the same way that we are, I think it goes to show that the president has his view of how things should be. And if you have a differing opinion or view, your place is not in this administration.
Now Alan Moore,
that's as nice as I can put it.
Yeah, now, Alan Moore, we saw the five top intelligence heads testify on the Hill about 2 weeks ago and was completely rebuffed by the president. The people I've talked to inside the White House have said that he was literally lit on fire based on the responses that the heads of the different intelligence community agencies gave to that committee during the hearing. And that I've also heard that the president is so dissatisfied with Dan Coats, Dan Coats' job is not secure. Does that trouble you?
Well, I think Coats is gone, and it's amazing he has sort of stayed around as long as he had. We get tired of talking about all of these loyal Americans who decide they just better better swallow their knowledge and their pride and do this for the good of the country. You know, it kept Mattis around a long time, and
McMaster. It's the same.
And Kelly, arguably,
right,
longer than he. You know, in the worst job he ever had, hanging around. But I think Ken was right on target here about why this president does this. He is used to being surrounded by yes men and women, and if you don't agree with him, he will find a way to move you out, to complain about you, to talk about his other friends. What do you think about this person or that person? He really doesn't want to hear a contrary voice. Now, if he had a basis of experience, knowledge, history, government, economics, where you felt that he's a really smart guy on this stuff. I mean, Bill Clinton, for all of his flaws, he was a genius in terms of public policy. He'd been a student of it since high school, for gosh sakes. He really knew a lot. Now, he didn't rely on just one or two people, but he had a basis of knowledge that he could build on. This president had no such basis. This president didn't know that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican and thought he should share that with the country when he discovered it, because he thought maybe they didn't
maybe
know.
Maybe Americans
also
didn't know
and
that.
And maybe a surprising number of them don't. But this person gets a thought in his mind.
But George W. Bush, hold on. George W. Bush did not come to this job when he was elected the 43rd president with a huge background in intelligence, other than the fact that his father was former director of Central Intelligence.
Don't even bring up the name of any other president to have this conversation, because it's so far removed from the reality and ignorance of Donald Trump. These guys were all geniuses, students, or who understood what they didn't know, and had people around them who knew things and who they would listen to and then draw their own judgments. This president has a intelligence briefing about once every 2 weeks.
He's having one on Thursday,
by
the way.
And notoriously doesn't really listen all that much. He has got this weird gut instinct, and if he has one or two people around him who reinforce that view. On trade, he's got this whack job named Peter Navarro, who tends to agree with the president that tariffs are a good idea. Nobody else around him, so far as I can tell, think that the tariffs are a good idea. But he's got Navarro, and then he's just ready to roll. People will push things aside and sit on things. So when he's got this view of intelligence, but I think there was one thing in history that influenced him, and that is how the intelligence agencies made huge mistakes in going into Iraq. And you see him talk about that all the time when somebody will say, well, why don't you trust it? Well, they messed up on Iraq, and that was one of the biggest mistakes in American history.
You know what's funny? I just want to jump on that, because here's the funny thing is he will make fun and discount his own intelligence community for the intelligence breakdowns that happened going into Iraq back in 2003. But what he doesn't admit is that part of the actual intelligence, the actionable intelligence that our government used, came from the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, who were active participants in this. He will speak greatness of the Mossad, but not even consider talking about the greatness of our intelligence community, only to bring up the fact that we missed the boat on September 11, 2001, and we missed the boat in 2003 invading Iraq.
We constantly apply norms of how government historically has worked, how government
should
work.
But that's all we know, Alan.
How the policy process should work.
That's all we know.
That's right. And he
doesn't know any of that.
He knows none of it, and he's the president. And he has got, as a 71, whatever old he is now, narcissist who's somehow been able to successfully navigate the world of the weird, strange real estate in New York and so on. He looks around and says, I'm so much smarter than all these other people. And I'm president. So it worked to not have to learn, to not have to listen. Trust your gut.
But this is a guy who said, I know more than generals about Afghanistan and ISIS.
And we know it's not true.
We know it's not true. But
well, we do.
Well, does he know
it? But here's,
we don't know if he knows
it. Here's where I have a concern. For decades, for generations, since there has been an intelligence community in this country, as we know it modern day, there has been a presidential daily briefing that has been given to each president by the intelligence community on threats against the United States. Until now, there is no presidential daily briefing as we know it. And when the intelligence community, when... For those who don't know, without getting into all kinds of super squirrel, secret squirrel stuff. The Presidential Daily Briefing is a daily report that is brought at the beginning of the President's Day by the Central Intelligence Agency from Langley over to the White House. That briefing is giving and gives a threat assessment against on a daily basis. This does not occur under this president. The briefings that they give him have lots of pictures and lots of graphics, not text, not intelligence data, but pictures and graphics. They've started calling it the coloring book. That disturbs me. That disturbs me. That the fact that we don't get a presidential daily briefing the way we have to give him pictures. That's sad. But again, this is a guy who thinks he knows more than his own intelligence community. And unless he's got his own intelligence service, I don't know how he does. Admiral Ken.
So before we move off of Andy McCabe, I want to say one thing.
What's that?
He's got a certain level of respect for me. And this is
and by the way, this all ties into Andy McCabe and the intelligence community. This is all the same
and
thing.
And this is the point I'm making. My spouse, and I know Alan feels the same way about his, is my world. And sitting across the table from someone ridiculing my spouse and being able to walk away from it without leaving the room in handcuffs, that takes a special kind of person. And Andy McCabe, in that regard, is a special kind of person.
He was just waiting for his chance, and now it's all coming out.
Oh, yeah.
The way that the president treated him and his wife, it's just deplorable. It's just disgusting. And for to think that a president would do that, oh my Lord, it's just one of the many mind bogglers.
I would invite everybody to go read, and I don't know who has, go read the op-ed in the Washington Post on April 2nd. Of last year, written by Jill McCabe, talking about setting the story straight regarding the idea that she was wholly funded by the Clinton Foundation or Clintons.
Doesn't matter.
That she somehow colluded with her husband on the investigation with Trump and everything. It is, go read it. I'm not even going to try and paraphrase it. It's worth the read. But I also agree with the fact that, you know, I've never known, even presidents that I don't always support. Like, I was never the biggest supporter of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, but never in a million years would I ever expect the president in the Oval Office to look at your acting director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and call your wife a loser. That to me is just stunning, stunning, which
I think it actually was on the phone, but it doesn't matter. It's the same whole idea.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to say one thing more about the president watching his five intelligence chiefs dispute him and how angry he got. It is one more of the many reminders that this president does not understand what the role of senior government officials is, which is to speak truth when appearing in public, particularly to the Congress. And whether they enjoy contradicting the nonsense that the president so often spouts, or whether they're just sort of swallowing hard but doing their duty— that's what they do. They're just saying, here's what we see. Here are the facts that we have seen separately and collectively, and this is what we conclude. And the president sees them as being disloyal. He measures so much in terms of loyalty. It doesn't matter if I'm wrong. I'm your boss. You have to support me. Coming back to Ken's earlier comment, he tries to run this the way he ran his real estate business, where people around him maybe would say, well, there's this or there's that, or I disagree.
Do you consider John Bolton a yes man?
I think they all have a little pact with the devil. I don't think of him as a yes man, but he's obviously figured out what battles to pick. we all have done this at different times.
Same thing with Mike Pompeo, with Mike Pence.
In jobs. I mean, I can't imagine that there's anybody there who has unbridled loyalty and support and respect for this president. However, he is the president. They have figured out how to have some influence on him and have decided that they would rather stay where they
are
and have that influence.
When it comes to Middle East policy, when it comes to international affairs, who has more of the president's ear? Is it the son-in-law or the Secretary of State?
Or the National Security Advisor.
Either one of those three.
No, it's all of them. And the thing.
But who does he listen to?
He listens to all of them, but he mostly listens to who comes in last, and usually that's his son-in-law. But that doesn't mean that Pompeo, Bolton haven't had some conversations figuring out.
We have a president that is literally figuring foreign and national security policy off of last-minute discussions with his son-in-law, who is one step away from having legal problems of his own.
We can guess that. We don't know for sure how this works. There, I mean, I go read the Woodward book, because it talks about how some of this stuff has worked over time, where the president will have different voices. He gets impatient. He walks out of the room. He cuts things off. There's a problem with Ivanka and with Jared, who can come in around the side, can go over to the residence, and he famously kind of listens mostly to the last voice in. That's what why we pulled out of Syria. Apparently, Erdogan says, "You guys have won. You can get out." It was like, yes. That's what I've been saying. That's what Steve Bannon used to say to me. Let's go. Let's get out of here. And then all hell breaks loose, and he thinks, oh, darn.
Right.
But I'm the president, and they need to be loyal to me and get behind me.
We've got a couple of minutes, and I know you wanted to talk real quickly about the 2020 election. But last question regarding all of this is what we're hearing out of Andrew McCabe an alarm clock for American electorate, or just more political rhetoric? Alan Moore.
It's more of the same troubling information about this president and how he functions.
Admiral Ken.
I think I agree. I think that if you're not alarmed yet, then you're not going to be.
All right, fair enough. In case you didn't hear about it, the 2020 Democratic slate seeking the nomination from the Democratic Party is getting bigger and bigger, along with the first eight that have gotten in, which includes Senator Kamala Harris of California, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, who's thrown his hat in.
You name them all off here all night long.
True. Latest additions include one Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, who is now running as a Democrat. Slate now is up to 14 confirmed, I believe. Alan Moore. Are the Democrats really pulling a playbook from the 2016 Republican slate? Because it looks identical. It looks like they could actually pull out a loss at a sure victory.
Well, it's interesting because it remember the last time on the Republican side, there was no logical heir apparent, and so it was wide open, and that's how and there was a real opportunity, even though it seemed like a long shot that they would that it seemed like they would be running against Hillary Clinton, and that would be a tough battle. And the one thing around which there was agreement early on was that Donald Trump would not be the candidate. And now we've got this free for all among the Democrats, six of whom are in the Senate, which, you know, as being this old Senate guy, it's just delicious. They're all buddy-buddy. They're great friends. And before long, they're going to be sticking in the needle. Learning how to do that from Bernie Sanders and the way he did it to Hillary Clinton last time around, they have every possibility of screwing this up.
Go ahead, Admiral Kahn.
So in shows past, you've heard me, you know, throw out advice to Trump supporters. And you've also heard me admonish Dan when he tried to tell me how to be a better Republican. So remembering that, hey, Democrats, you guys are supposed to be evolving smart people. Watch what happened to the Republicans last time. If you really want Donald Trump to win again,
straight out of the playbook.
Do it, baby.
Straight out of the playbook. Here's the question is, because ironically, the guy who I think might be this underdog sleeper that nobody's, you know, it could be the Democrats' Donald Trump, but he actually has a brain, is this mayor out of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. I mean, would you ever have expected that the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, would ever declare as a presidential candidate for the Democratic ticket?
Well, at least he's
and have a possibility of it.
At least he's got a job, unlike Beto O'Rourke and the former representative from Maryland, who's thrown in his
John Delaney
his hat. It's a bizarre run. We're waiting on Joe Biden. I think Bernie Sanders' time came and went. It'll just flabbergast me if his ideas, a number of which have been embraced by some of the current candidates of high minimum wage, free college, Medicare for all. Now he's a guy who will be 79.
And for the first time, we're hearing terms like Democratic socialist.
Well, but you got people like Kamala Harris and
Cory Booker.
She ran away from that, as well as the lady from the Midwest,
Amy Klobuchar.
I mean, they're running away from that big.
Well, Amy Klobuchar is literally pulling the centrist move, out of everybody might be the smart move.
It is the smart,
except
move.
Nobody likes her.
Yeah.
Well, most of all,
and most of all, her own
staff.
Her staff
loves her. Or the state loves her. But all this stuff about staff, for those of us who've been
we'll talk about that in another show.
Yeah, that's a
we'll
mess.
Talk about that when we go in depth on that, which we'll do next week. But the bottom line is, do you expect between now and when we talk about this in depth next week, does Beto O'Rourke jump in? Is now the right time, or does he hold out, Alan Moore?
The time is at hand, whether it's next week, the week after, but you know,
same thing with Biden.
They have to be in by the end of March, because there's too much action. There's too many staff people who are being snapped up. Donors, they're all going to look for this broad-based donor thing. Everybody thinks
they're all going to do the $1 donor.
Well,
deal.
Everybody thinks that Beto is going to pull in all this money again, or that Bernie is, but I don't think there's any guarantee
of that. Did you see the numbers on Bernie today? Within 3 hours of announcing, he's already raised $1 million. 3 hours.
He's going to need a lot more than $1 million in a few hours.
Well, look, if he can raise $1 million in 3 hours.
I can put a picture of you on the internet and get $1 million, Justin.
No, you can't. No, you can't. Trust me. I can tell you.
All right.
No, you cannot. That is categorically not true. Because if that were true, I wouldn't be doing this.
We could test it.
No, we can't. We're good with that. With that being said, I cannot believe that. Really, dude? Really? Wow. You know what? Wait. Come on, Mike here, Rob the engineer. Are you playing me off stage?
Well, I can help you guys out with some corners of the internet if you want.
No, we're good.
Reality.
No comment. Rob the engineer behind the glass, thank you as always. Our producer, Audrey Harrington, thank you as always, madam. On behalf of Admiral Ken Carradine and Alan Moore, I am your host and moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back with the best political talk show you've never heard of. here at Podcast Village in Studio A in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. You can follow us on Twitter at Backroom Politic, where you can hear this live broadcast every Tuesday. You can download all of our shows, including this one, from our website, backroompolitics.org, or on any podcasting service you use, whether it's iTunes, Google Podcasts. Hey, we're on Spotify, too. Go figure. We're going big time, kids. We will see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the best political talk show you've never heard of. Have a great week, America.